I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Eula Biss. Download the MP3 of our produced show with her at onbeing.org. Let's just talk, and then if we have to pause, we'll do that.
Great.
Okay, we can pick something back up. I was saying that, you know, Chris, I feel like I lost one in one ear. I stopped getting that weird. There's something funny about working with technology.
It's Friday.
I know. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, what is that? Yeah, is no, gone? That's better.
Okay.
Okay, I'll touch it again. Okay. All right. So, that's kind of how I'm going into this. And by the way, as you know, that also does touch on even the work you did with On Immunity. So, but where I start my conversations always is inquiring about the religious or spiritual background of someone's childhood. And I know you've said that somewhere that grew up a stranger to Western religious tradition in any case. But I'm really interested in an expansive definition of, you know, the spiritual background of your childhood and perhaps how it really, what you think helped form you in terms of your sense of inner life, human wholeness, human dignity, these things you reflect on now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of religion, my background's a little complicated in that my father was raised Catholic, and he was a very serious Catholic and served as an altar boy, but was no longer in the church by the time he had children. And I spent the first part of my childhood longing to have a religion.
Right.
Our neighbors were evangelical Christians, and I just felt like they had something that I didn't have, a relationship with God that I wanted. And then when I was 10 or 11, my mother became part of the Yoruba tradition. And this is a West African religion.
Yeah.
That it's made its way through slavery and the diaspora to the States. And she and our family were part of a Yoruba community in upstate New York for a few years till I went to college. And somewhere in there, let's see, I think at maybe the same moment that she got involved with the Yoruba tradition, I was insisting that I wanted church, proper church. And this was something that my mother wasn't going to do. But our compromise was that for a year I went to the Unitarian Church that was in our area, which was wonderful. I somehow landed there in exactly the year when that Unitarian Church did sex ed with my age group. So I didn't get God. I got sex every Sunday for a year. And that's what the Unitarians gave to me. It was a very sex positive community. So that's what I got from that community. And the Yoruba community that we were part of was a really rich, incredibly valuable experience for me. Those teachings and those stories are still part of my thinking. I think for the most part, my own spiritual practice is somewhat separate from tradition. I never had enough of a footing in any religious tradition for my spirituality to feel like grounded in a religious tradition. But both Catholicism and the Yoruba tradition have fed my thinking.
That's really interesting. And as I said to you before we started speaking, I really want to focus, I want to frame our conversation around ideas that you pulled together so compellingly in this article you wrote in the New York Times December 2015 called White Debt, Reckoning with What is Owed and What Can Never Be Repaid for Racial Privilege. Mm-hmm. But as I, so I've been looking forward all year to having this conversation with you. But as I then finally started preparing to interview you, I realized as I read, you know, what you've been writing for a long time, you've actually been living and thinking around this subject for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you have a cousin who's, as you wrote in your notes from No Man's Land. When did you publish that book, by the way?
That was 2009.
Mm-hmm. You know, you wrote, it very much centers around themes of race, and you actually have in your family a cousin who's of mixed race. There are mixed race adoptions in your family. In fact, most of our families, if we trace them fully, we would probably mm-hmm. find this. But your mother's longtime boyfriend when you were a teenager was African American. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, this is something I'm happy to talk about this, and mm-hmm. I'll illuminate the details. But this is something that I do try to resist, the idea that there's something unique or special about the kind of racial makeup of my family
yeah.
that made me, you know, attuned to race, because I feel like that supports this idea that only people who are racially other have an entryway into
yeah.
race, and it kind of supports this idea that being white is not racialized, right? This idea that if you're white, you're nothing, and there's no reason to think about nothing, right? And this was I ran into this a lot actually after that book came out in 2009. A lot of the questions I got were questions along the lines of, What's special in your background that makes you authorized? You know, really the gist of these questions was, what authorizes you to speak on race? And my answer was, I too live in America, and I too exist in a racialized space, and whiteness is in this country a race. And
yeah.
So that's my preamble to the answer.
And
the answer
yeah.
is that I think you're right. I think most American families are in one way or another somewhat racially complicated. Mine was maybe especially so. I have an uncle from Jamaica. I have mixed race cousins. I have a cousin who was adopted and has Native American lineage. And my household when I was growing up was mixed. And my stepsister was black. My stepfather was black. My niece was black. So this was, you know, and I think, and then the community, my mother's religious community, was a very ethnically, racially diverse community that had Native Americans, African Americans, and Puerto Ricans in that community. So there was, I was exposed, I guess, to people from a lot of different backgrounds. But I think, I don't think that is in America all that unusual either.
Yeah, right. right. Yeah, I agree. I think I'll go ahead and do this. I actually, there's just this paragraph that I love in Notes from No Man's Land. Where you're talking about your cousin. Maybe this is just because I think questions make the world go around. You said, I feel like an unknown quantity, my cousin remarked at some point during the year that we lived together. This is your mixed race cousin. She was referring to the algebraic term, the unknown quantity X, which must be solved for or defined by the numbers in the equation around it. I remember when I first encountered algebra, feeling the limits of my own comprehension break around the concept that one number in an equation could be unknown. And what baffled me most was that the answer in algebra was known, but the question was incomplete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think it's in that analogy you make there is an interesting way to talk about how we are grasping now to grapple with this, and mm-hmm. that we don't even have the right questions. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I may be reading into it, but that really jumped out at me.
No, I that's exactly, I think, what I was reaching towards. And I think this idea that I think a lot of our, even the questions we're asking around race are incomplete. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, to circle around to this, you were saying about that piece, White Debt, that you liked that it didn't frame the problem as the presence of non-white people in this country, right? And that's somehow, that's sometimes how we ask questions about race, right? Is why are these people who aren't white causing so many problems? Where that's, to my eye, that's not the question to ask. Yeah. And I think I was reminded of this recently when I read this classic work of economics called The Affluent Society. It's Kenneth Galbraith, I think that's the author. Anyways, in there he starts out by saying that he had intended to do a study of poverty in the United States, and he wanted to study the poor, and that in this study of poverty, I don't think he really even got into it. He embarked on it and made the realization that maybe the problem is not poverty. Maybe the problem is affluence. And so it's instead of being a study of poverty, it's a study of affluence. And it's incredibly interesting. And he kind of illuminates the problems that our particular brand of affluence has caused for our society, and how building this particular kind of affluence has hurt our society as a whole, right? Hurt the affluent as well as the poor. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that's a really good analogy for race. You know, I think the problem all along has been whiteness and defining whiteness against a group that must then be considered a lesser in order for whiteness to be a privileged category. Yeah. And that's, we can trace that historically, but it's also, it's a contemporary attitude, as subterranean as it might be, you know, as buried as it might be now, it's still an attitude.
Yeah, And you are also, well, I don't know, gosh, I want to go so many places with. So, you know, I had a conversation last year with John Powell. Are you familiar with his work? He's at Berkeley.
No.
Anyway, he's a great, he's a legal scholar, but he's a wonderful voice on race and all of these kind of front lines in our society right now around race. And, you know, one thing he says is race is relational. And I found a kind of a parallel definition for, you know, race is a social fiction, but it is also a social fact. I mean, that's another way of talking about that. I mean, because, you know, what is whiteness? And once you start to talk about it, we can describe the phenomenon, the way we all live around this idea. In fact, the idea, I mean, you also say whiteness is not kinship or a culture. White people are no more closely related to one another genetically than we are to black people.
Yeah, it is, you know, there's tons of great scholarship around this idea that race is socially constructed, and there's people who can speak on that much better than I can, but I do think it's important, you know, the other half of that equation, it's a myth, but it's a social reality too. It's, we live within this myth that we've made. But a surprising number of people do consider race a biological fact.
Yeah.
So, and that's some of the pushback I got from that article was people saying, what do you mean it's not real? And, you know, I had a correspondence actually with someone who wrote to me after that piece, White Debt, came out. And I was talking about how in different countries, race is understood differently. And this is one of the examples that was useful to me when I first encountered this subject was that in Brazil, the history of thinking around race is different than it is here.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of inversion of our, you know, the United States has this one drop rule. Historically, if you have one drop of discernible African-American blood, you will be considered non-white, right? And in Brazil, that's inverted. So if you have any discernible European heritage, you're white. And so the vast majority of people in Brazil who would look in our country, we would call them non-white, are considered white in Brazil. So there's, you know, this is one illustration of how it's our categories around race are actually quite fluid. There are no biological markers for these categories because they are social inventions.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're not important, right? That doesn't mean that they don't affect how people live and how people experience the world and how they get treated, most importantly, right? And but also their economic and social legacy.
Yeah. And I find one thing I love about this article you wrote and and about your writing in general is that you know, one way you try to approach this subject with some directness and some freshness, you know, maybe again to draw on what we were talking about a minute ago about, you know, kind of, I would say, you know, turning the questions. You interrogate words, just, you know, individual words, language that always appears in this conversation that we don't really know how to have. Language, interrogating language as a way of searching for better understanding. So that, you know, whiteness is there. And then also the word privilege, which you noted is composed of the Latin words for private and law. And when you write about that, you reflect on an experience you had of actually, not that you knew it at the time, but committing a felony while you were at college. So talk about that, about how you have come to understand privilege.
Sure. Yeah. You know, the etymologies of words, and you know, maybe this is my way to insight because I'm a writer, but the etymologies of words are always very revealing to me. And this word privilege has been in the air for me for a very long time. And it's a word that I've used for years before I understood its etymology. And when I saw the Latin roots of privilege, I suddenly understood the word much better. It became much clearer to me. I guess the concept got clarified. And I think what's sometimes missing from that concept is that idea that if one person has privilege, another person doesn't, right? So I remember having a conversation with some other writers who are also mothers of young children, and we were talking about privilege. And one of the mothers said in frustration, she said, well, I don't think me having privilege is a problem. I just think everyone should have it.
Right.
And, you know, but the very definition of privilege makes that impossible, right? It's something that you have only because someone else does not. So this idea of privilege being a private law, I think, illuminates that quality of privilege where if you have a law that only applies to you, that necessarily means the laws are different for other people and that kind of privilege cannot be shared. It's not something that everyone is going to have. If everyone has the same laws, then privilege doesn't exist. And, you know, and I do think that that's where we need to what we need to work towards as a society, right, is where the laws apply to everyone equally. But, yeah, you know, I've actually had a number of experiences where I either understood immediately or I came to understand that the laws of our country were applying to me differently than they might apply to someone else. Mm-hmm. But that experience from college came from a moment when some friends and I were organizing a series of talks on race, actually, at Hampshire College. And one of our speakers was Billy Upski, who's he's an activist and a graffiti artist. And we took an image from his book. His book is called Bomb the Suburbs. And we took an image from it and made a poster. And the poster said, Bomb the Suburbs. And a friend of mine and I wheat pasted these posters, huge posters, all over the town of Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm unreformed because I still find this funny. And it's true that I didn't think a lot about what I was doing. You know, we climbed buildings. We put it on the plate glass window of the pizza shop. We put it on billboards. These posters were all over Amherst. And the day after we pasted all these posters up all over town, our campus police officer came to visit us. And he said, I'm going to have to take you for an interview with the Amherst police. And I think we had realized that we could get in some trouble, but it hadn't occurred to us that we could get in that much trouble. And it definitely had not crossed my mind that I had committed a felony. I also did not know that graffiti was considered a felony, that it could be punishable as a felony. But what we had done fell under that category for the Amherst police, and we were brought in for questioning, and we did deny everything, and we were eventually let go with the promise that we were going to clean everything up. So we never admitted to doing it, but everyone in that room understood that we'd done it and our job was to clean it up. Yeah. And this was a case where I after the fact, I began to piece together that the law that made graffiti a felony was not designed to punish a white college student who was publicizing her event on campus. Right. And that is part of why that issue didn't get pushed any farther with me and with my white friend. Yeah. Does that mean that law is just for anyone? No. And that was one of those moments where the concept of privilege was opened for me a little bit, illuminated.
I do feel like a lot of us who are white, especially those of us who have children, have been becoming more aware of those kinds of examples recently. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one thing that's kind of rising to the surface. I remember Michelle Alexander, who's African-American, who wrote The New Jim Crow, but she went to, I think it was Emory, talking about all the people who are in prison for doing things, partying or, facilitating drug taking that she and, that people at liberal arts colleges, elite colleges do all the time, mm-hmm. and they are simply not in the same kind of danger of being treated as criminals for that. Mm-hmm. And there's so many examples of this.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many. Mm-hmm. I was just this summer, I live in Evanston, Illinois, and there's beaches along Lake Michigan here. And just this summer, the day after, a group of African-American high school kids who were drinking beer on the beach got taken in by the police, but got arrested. And the next day, my husband and I were walking by the beach, and we saw a group of our neighbors, white neighbors, standing around on the beach. Their kids were playing, and they were drinking out of red plastic cups, the kind that, like, frat boys drink out of.
Yeah.
And they were drinking wine. Everyone knew they were drinking wine. Like, I'm sure the lifeguard knew they were drinking wine. And my husband said to me, "That's what white privilege looks like." And that was an instance where there's these, 40-year-olds who are drinking wine on the beach are not going to be held to the law that says you can't drink on the beach, but the African-American teenagers are.
Yeah.
And that's another case where the same law is being applied differently.
And it feels like on the surface that feels so like such a— well, it doesn't feel harmless. It doesn't feel harmless the minute you realize that somebody else was punished for it, for doing it, right?
Right.
It's such a simple thing. I mean, one of the other words that you take apart, you say that the word complacence, as you looked at the roots of that word, the etymology of that word, that in fact it did not mean what you expected it to mean. And that also was a way to reflect on this.
Yeah, I think I was looking for— when I was looking for a word to describe what I felt like the dominant white attitude was, or the dominant white mindset was, I was looking for a word that would describe a kind of blindness that was— that wasn't even willful, right?
And
when I looked at the meaning of the word complacent, it actually looked more intentional than the meaning I was searching for. because I think that that's part of the problem is the attitude is highly unintentional. It's highly unexamined. Yeah. It's relaxing into your own privilege without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that, again, is one of the privileges of being white, right, mm-hmm. is that you can coast through your experience, you can coast through your life without having to think about what your race means to other people and what your existence in a community means to the people around you.
Yeah. You cite this essay by Claudia Rankine that she wrote in the New York Times Magazine after the massacre in the church in Charleston. She wrote, I asked another friend what it's like being the mother of a black son. The condition of black life is mourning, she said bluntly. Mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. For her, mourning lived in real time inside her and her son's reality. At any moment, she might lose her reason for living. Though the white liberal imagination likes to feel temporarily bad about black suffering, there really is no mode of empathy that can replicate the daily strain of knowing that as a black person, you can be killed for simply being black. No hands in your pockets, no playing music, no sudden movements, no driving your car, no walking at night, no walking in the day, no turning onto this street, no entering this building, no standing your ground, no standing here, no standing there, no talking back, no playing with toy guns, no living while black. And you wrote, sitting with her essay in front of me, I asked myself what the condition of white life might be. I know that word complacence is something that you reflected on, but I wonder how would you think about that question right now, what the condition of white life might be, how to start to summarize that or to evoke that?
Yeah, well, I guess my mind, it goes right to the particulars and that moment that you read from Claudia's essay. She's an incredibly powerful writer.
Yes.
And that moment that you read made me think of a meeting that I was recently in at my son's elementary school. I think because of Claudia's friend talking about her son and the question of how to keep him safe. And I was at a meeting that was parents discussing how we were going to bring the issue of talking about race to the school community. And there was a huge range of experience in this room. There were parents who had not talked to their children about race at all. And there were parents for whom it was a daily concern. And there was a Kenyan woman there who was saying that the way her children looked every day had everything to do with how dangerous she understood it to be black in America. And she talked about the way she dressed her two children and the way she taught them to talk to strangers and the way she taught them to act in public. And I was thinking about how few of those concerns I had shared, especially around safety, in terms of I haven't spent time training my son in ways of being polite, for instance, because I'm afraid that someone will kill him. And I think that doesn't directly answer your question, but it points back towards the state of white life or the state we're in.
Yeah.
I have, and I do also think that another indicator of where we are around race is that my decision to talk to my son about race from a very early age, so we started talking about race when he was 2 or 3, is considered somewhat controversial among the other white parents that I know. And even the fact that there'd be some controversy around that, the fact that I would get letters from strangers telling me that talking to my son about race amounts to child abuse.
What was the connection?
So, in this piece, White Debt, that was published in the New York Times, I recount a few conversations that I had with my son around race.
Yes, okay.
And a number of letters that I received after the fact let me know that they that other parents considered this abusive, inappropriate, harmful to my son, that I was cultivating self-hatred in this young white boy by having conversations with him starting when he was quite young about what it means to be white in this country and what the legacy of whiteness is here. You know, I think that that also is a little window into where we are. And I consider it absolutely essential, especially where we live, for my son to have as comprehensive an understanding of his place in the racial dynamic as he possibly can. And so I did have conversations with him that I think many parents would have considered a 3-year-old too young to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought I was thinking of, you know, a story that went through my mind just now as I was reading that passage from Claudia Rankine. Mm-hmm. Again, it was my son who's bigger than yours, who's now 18. But the last couple of years, he did something at high school, which is a tradition here, this kind of bizarre tradition at Twin Cities High Schools called Nerf Wars. Mm-hmm. And despite myself, I kind of got caught up in the gleefulness of these kids with these stupid looking purple, you know, kind of plastic guns, but they don't, mm-hmm. I mean, they mostly don't look like guns, coming up with these great strategies to corner people in their yards and in their garages. And it was teamwork. But so most of the guns don't look like guns, but some of them actually do. And the thing is, I found myself terrified for the African-American friend of his on his team. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't terrified for my son. Mm-hmm. I mean, really terrified, because it just felt incredibly dangerous. And it's kind of having that conversation with my son. The thing is, we and our kids live with this. It's also a remove from that reality, right? Even those of us who care. I mean, you live in Chicago, right? You're at Northwestern. I mean, you're in a suburb.
I live right outside Chicago. So I live in Evanston now. I've moved. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just now, like, we're talking at a moment where the Cubs have just won the World Series. Mm-hmm. But in this same period of time, I remember reading the scrolls on the news screen about how many teenagers were killed in Chicago, you know, last weekend. And I ask myself, is that the same Chicago? Are all those people celebrating the World Series as well? Or, you know, I live in a placid, kind of high-functioning, leave-it-to-beaver neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota, the kind of neighborhood where you can, you know, I moved here because your kids can get on their bicycle on a Saturday morning and not come back until dinner time. You don't ever worry about them. But right around the corner from my house, like 5 blocks from my house this year, Philando Castile was shot. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we have to talk about this with our kids, because somehow, even though we are inhabiting our cities together, we're not having the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated and disturbing when you start to look at it that way.
It is. It really is. And, you know, this fall, an article came out that really rattled some parents in our neighborhood, including me. An article came out in Bloomberg News that was about the high school that is here, Evanston Township High School, which is high school for all of Evanston.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I've got a tickle in my throat now.
It's okay. You take a drink of water if you need one.
Oh, that would be great. Thanks so much. Sorry, I'm just going to wait for the water
so I can complete my thought
without coughing through
okay.
it.
All right.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Thank you so much. So I appreciate it. Thank you. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm going to back up a couple phrases.
Yeah. Okay.
So this fall, an article came out in Bloomberg News that was making the rounds of conversation in my neighborhood. It was an article about Evanston Township High School, which is the high school that serves everyone in Evanston. So it's necessarily a highly integrated high school. I think the numbers are slightly more than 50% white, and then the rest of the school is African American and Hispanic. And a series of studies, one of them done at Stanford and another done within the Evanston school districts, found that in these integrated schools that we have in Evanston, black students and white students are not getting the same education.
Yeah.
And so this is even within the same buildings with the same teachers, within the same physical space. And the other disturbing fact is that even if you control for income, that black students who are middle class or upper middle class are still not getting the education that white students who are middle class are getting.
So you can't say, oh, this is about the support they don't have at home, right?
And, right. So and I think it's still unclear exactly what the nature of the problem is. But one of the phrases that came up in this article, that one of the researchers used a phrase, opportunity hoarding. And they use this phrase to describe what white parents do to make sure that their students, that their children are getting more than other children are getting. And this phrase was really resonant for me. And I really thought about both the opportunity hoarding that I had seen around me and the opportunity hoarding that I myself had engaged in. And one example of opportunity hoarding that I'm just remembering from this article was that, for instance, something a little over 90% of white students at Evanston Township High School have taken at least one advanced placement class. Mm-hmm. And the numbers for African-American students are around 50%. So there's many more white students, disproportionate amount of white students ending up in advanced placement classes. And there's probably a lot of factors that feed into that, right? There's parent advocacy. There's probably some racial bias going on the part of the school. There's probably dozens of different factors. But the one that I think the reason that term opportunity hoarding spoke to me is I thought, well, that's something I can control for. Like, that's something that's something I can watch in my own behavior. And that's something that I could have conversations with my neighbors around and how we're treating the opportunities that are available to our children, and whether we're ensuring that those opportunities are available to all the children in our community.
And don't you think also, that's a kind of, it's an unsettling phrase, opportunity hoarding. But it almost feels like it speaks to that notion of privilege that we walk around with, that cultivating privilege. And, you know, when it comes to our children, there's such a fierce drive that we have, right, to give them the best, to do, right, mm-hmm. to make things possible for them. It doesn't even, it's not, I think, consciously about wanting them to flourish at the expense of someone else. But what you're pointing out and what that language makes clear is that, in fact, that is what happens. And maybe I'm wrong that it's always unconscious.
And that, especially when we're talking about limited resources,
right.
if those limited resources are hoarded, it necessarily means somebody isn't getting them. Yeah. So if it's an unlimited resource, then the question is different. It's how do we get this unlimited resource to everyone?
Yeah.
But a limited resource is a different kind of problem. If some people have it, another group of people is not going to have it.
Yeah.
So it's I think it does. And for me, it recalls all the legalized ways in which white people have engaged in opportunity hoarding historically over several hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this thinking got refreshed for me when I bought a house here in Evanston. And buying a house and getting a mortgage inspired me to do a little bit of research into housing laws and the history of redlining in my community and the history of housing discrimination and mortgage discrimination in Chicago. And Ta-Nehisi Coates has written really beautifully about this, and especially in his piece, The Case for Reparations. He very elegantly lays out a history of legalized housing discrimination. And some of his examples, his particulars, come from Chicago. And when you look at that history, you can see a highly intentional and entirely legal history of white people hoarding both real estate and financial resources like mortgages at the expense of other people. And even, you know, in the case of predatory lending, there's people making money at the expense of African-American families who lose their houses because of the unfair loans that they've been given, the poor terms of lending. Was another, you know, buying a house was another moment where I felt that I was kind of forced to reflect on how I was benefiting personally from a long history of racist policies in my country.
I was just speaking with Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, and very much to that point, you know, she talks about when there was this exodus of, you know, 6 million African Americans in the 20th century from the South to the North. They were still, you know, they could only live in certain places, and those certain places, you know, turn out to now be our inner cities, and were charged exorbitant rates to live in places, you know, because they had no choice. It wasn't. And that is built in. That is in the DNA of our cities. You're right, and that was very intentional. Whereas I think we can imagine that there's not racism behind a lot of what happens now. I mean, you started, that's the buying of the house was kind of the image that you worked with in this New York Times piece of and really delving into the meaning of debt and the experience of debt.
Yeah.
And moral,
yeah, and
moral
I
debt
do think,
as well.
Yeah, the moral debt. You know, what really broke that piece open, I knew for a long time that I wanted to write about the feelings I was having around buying and owning a house and getting a mortgage. But what broke that piece open was a conversation with my neighbors who had lived in Germany. And one of my neighbors mentioned to me that the word for debt in German is also the word for guilt.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Kind of, you know, that was very illuminating for me. I have for a long time wanted to think about white guilt in a way that could be productive, you know, both personally productive, but also socially and politically productive. It's a really, as a term, white guilt is pretty poisonous. People don't want to touch it or be accused of it or engage in it. But I wondered, you know, is there some way that a white person can admit moral culpability, right, and claim that in a way that isn't embarrassing or or cast as I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of all the ways that we treat white guilt.
Well,
you know,
it's
treated as silly, really. Or
even the notion of white privilege. Well, what I experience, you know, what we're very attentive to editorially when we put shows on the air around race, mm-hmm. around these issues that you could, you know, you want people to listen. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I personally don't think people get paralyzed or turn away because they don't care. I mean, maybe mm-hmm. it's true that sometimes mm-hmm. they don't care, but there's a paralysis that sets in, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's about, mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one reason, you know, one doesn't put guilt in a show title.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But you make a really interesting, first of all, I want to say, like, the way you talk, the kind of analogy with buying a house and then a kind of, you know, moral debt, you know, is that mm-hmm. you take loans against down payments and increase the riches you're living with, the ease of forgetting that we're paying for something, the ease of forgetting a debt at a certain amount of privilege, mm-hmm. the fact that once mm-hmm. you've been living in a house for a while, you believe it's yours, even though mm-hmm. you don't own it.
Mm-hmm.
But you also say that, you know, you are, I think you're arguing for saying, not letting guilt be a bad word, kind of honoring the fact that, I mean, you wrote, why not imagine guilt as a prod, a goad, an impetus to action? Isn't guilt an essential cog in the machinery of the conscience? Maybe mm-hmm. we should try to let this word in, welcome this word in this conversation about race. Like, I honestly think we talk about race when we don't know, when we talk about how we don't know how to talk about it. I mean, it's not even really mm-hmm. like we do have a national conversation about race. And maybe because we don't let the word guilt in. I mean, maybe that's, mm-hmm. this is important.
Yeah. And I do think in support, I do think, you know, circling it back to this question of, you know, what's the state of white life?
Yeah.
I do think the state of white life is that we're living in a house we believe we own, but that we've never paid off.
Yeah.
And that's a dangerous situation, and that I think it's both socially and psychologically dangerous to believe you own something that isn't yours.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that maybe the language that people could find more palatable, right? It would be this word responsibility, this word that we associate with adulthood and and drudgery.
Rather than shame. Yeah.
But that's another coloration of guilt, right? Is that there's that meaning of the word guilt that gestures at responsibility. Because I am culpable for this, I am now responsible.
Culpable for and benefiting from, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And benefiting from, you know, I think a lot of people want to wash their hands because the benefit has been indirect, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of cases, the culpability can feel indirect too, but it mm-hmm. doesn't make it right.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I have the unusual situation of living in a house. The house that we bought here in Evanston has an identical twin that's right next door to it. So we live in a little brick bungalow that is right next door to an identical brick bungalow. Mm. And these two brick bungalows were built by brothers. And neither of those brothers live in the houses anymore. But our next door neighbor is an African-American man who's been living in his house since I was born. And so we're a white family living in a house that's identical to the house of the black family next door, which has given me some occasions for reflection on the differences in our lives and the ways that we have or have not benefited from the systemic racism around us. So one example of that is before we moved into our house, the previous owner did a major renovation of the attic of this little bungalow. And I was describing this renovation to my next door neighbor over the fence, and he said, I'd love to do something like that to my attic. I would love to do it. I want so much to renovate our attic. I always have wanted to. And he said, but I'm never going to have the money for that. And this is a man who's worked his whole life. He's worked for the post office for longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
And he mentioned to me in an offhand way, he said, you know, I have a lot of family members who are in jail and who are in prison, and that's one of the draws on us financially is that yeah. is supporting the families of people who can't work, and so that's just one tiny window into how the criminalization of Black life is a draw financially on people who are not engaging in any activity who've never been accused of a crime, never.
Yeah.
And never then put in
can't
jail, never
renovate
imprisoned.
their attics to increase the price of their property and all of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and my neighbor left off this conversation. We were talking and he left off by saying, I guess God just didn't want me to be rich, you know. And I said, I don't think it's God, actually. It's,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. It feels so good to talk about this. It's so rare to talk about it. There's a sentence you had, in the piece, the white debt piece. I have written and erased 100 sentences here, trying and failing to articulate something that I can sense but not yet speak. And I wonder, I may be reading into this, but the truth is this is all so fraught and there are so many things kind of coming to the surface that in part feel very shocking, whether they should be shocking or not. You know, violence and kind of seeing the roots of things we haven't seen have... And there's, you know, I think one reason I appreciate that you work with language because language itself is so fraught and the wrong word can be, taken as an offense, even though we're reckless with other words.
Right. Yeah, I think that this is a major problem for us in terms of talking about race and... as much as attentive as I am to language and as sensitive as I am to it as a writer and as much as I believe that insight can be found or lost through language, I do think that when it comes to racism, we pay too much attention to language and we give language a power that... I don't believe it actually has. Mm. So quite a lot is made, quite a lot of theatrics goes into saying or not saying the right thing around race and using or not using the right words. So much so that you'd think, listening to Americans as an alien visitor from another planet, you'd think that the worst thing a human being could ever do is say the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, I think there are many graver actions that are happening that happen without anyone ever saying anything offensive. And that a lot of our policing of offensive language, it's not that that isn't unimportant. It's not that people should be allowed to say whatever they want. But I feel that there's extra energy put into that policing because we aren't sure how to address the real problems and how to address the kind of systemic racism that happens without anyone ever saying anything that would look to us like racism. And so, you know, I guess I feel particularly strongly about this because I'm a teacher and because I teach writing and I routinely work with students who want to write about race. And these are students from all different racial backgrounds who want to write about race but are afraid to even touch the subject because yeah. they're afraid they'll say the wrong thing. And they're afraid that once they say the wrong thing, they will be forever branded as in the wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that this is part of how we're hobbling ourselves around coming to kind of broader and more advanced understandings around what's going on with race.
And about that, how we live together as opposed to just how we talk together, how we speak together.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. can't, I think if you can't talk about something, you can't think about something. Mm. And I think I've worked with students who could barely let themselves think. They were so scared of thinking the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And so that I don't want to be misunderstood as making an argument for offensive language, mm-hmm. but I guess the argument that I'm making is that I think that we need a cultural atmosphere where we understand where the crimes are happening, right? And mm-hmm. that many of the crimes are not in the arena of language, but that we need to be able to stumble through imperfect language and imperfect sentences in order to find our way to where the crimes are happening.
Mm. I have a friend who's in her late 70s, and she was a professor, is a professor, and she told me a story about in the mid-60s, when civil rights was happening, she had a close friend who was also a colleague, a fellow academic, who was African-American, and that they had a pact that, that Pauline had a kind of an agreement with her that She would bounce things off her that she was going to say or write and say, is this racist, right? Mm-hmm. does this work? Is this offensive? And I love that story, because it was self-correction in the context of a relationship, and she was safe yeah. enough, right, to ask yeah. to be corrected, as opposed to mm-hmm. so worried about getting something wrong that she wouldn't say anything. Mm-hmm. I feel like we've had this illusion here in our 21st century that we're way past that, right? Like we should mm-hmm. know what the wrong word would be, or what the offensive thought would be, or mm-hmm. what the mm-hmm. what the egregious omission would be, and we don't. You know,
right.
I mean, sadly,
right.
we should, but we don't. And mm-hmm. I've wished, you know, what if we could kind of sort of each have a friendship like that, mm-hmm. a yeah. safe space where we could err and ask to be. Have it pointed out lovingly so that we could get it right.
And you know, this is another way in which I really, really strongly believe that you know, for all the ways that white people benefit materially from racism, mm-hmm. that we're very damaged by it. And I think that this is one of the ways in which we're damaged, and the racist structures of our society cut us off from close friendships with people of color.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean we don't have them, right? But there's many ways in which we're alienated from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things we lose, right? That kind of productive conversation that can move a person's thinking forward and can expand a person's, not just their, you know, acceptable vocabulary,
yeah.
but also their real understanding.
Yeah, their understanding and their presence in the world, their ability to mm-hmm. move forward. It's also, you know, another very striking thing about this moment we inhabit is we're aware of all this unfinished business, you know, these things we actually thought we'd made so much progress on, but also seeing full circle that the legacy of whiteness is now costing white people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you, because of the writing you've done previously in this article, you found yourself somewhat in in that discussion. How do you, and I think that, you know, that's, it's been a factor in this, in the presidential campaign between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. How, talk to me a little bit about how you've thought about this specter, not the presidential campaign specifically, but this legacy of whiteness. And
You know, I think the person who I've encountered who's most articulate on this point is James Baldwin. And I've gotten so much out of reading James Baldwin. He has an essay called On Being White and Other Lies. And in that essay, he talks about the price that was paid by the people who were not white before they came to America. So he also makes a statement. He says nobody was white before they came to America. And he said, you know, those Poles and those Germans and those Austrians and the English, they were Austrians and Poles and English before they came to this country. And when they got here, they became white. And he said, what they paid, the price of the ticket, was their moral being. And and he also makes a statement in there that he says nobody paid more for the price of that ticket than Jews. And it's a really provocative, to me, really compelling essay that illuminates this idea that that we actually have paid for what we've gotten, but we've paid something we never should have given up, and that is, you know, what Baldwin calls your moral life, or your moral being, your responsibility to the people around you, the mutual obligation we have to other humans, this something very spiritually essential was traded for the material benefit, and that I think there's almost nobody better than Baldwin at illuminating the incredible loss, right, that racism has been for white people. I've learned actually probably more about being white from reading Baldwin than I have from any other source. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about his statements around the price of the ticket. And another place that helped me understand what that price of the ticket really looked like was Noel Ignatiev's book, How the Irish Became White. And this is a really interesting historical study that looks at how the Irish were not actually considered white when they first immigrated to this country. And he looks at the process by which the Irish came to be accepted as white. And that process was incredibly violent, incredibly brutal, and involved acquiescing in, again, brutal, violent, racist behavior. And that was the price of the ticket, a ticket that, you know, I consider overpaid.
Would you say a little bit about, more concretely, about what you look at in society today and say this was the price of the ticket?
Let me search my reservoir of examples for a minute.
I mean, just to make this concrete.
I know it is. It's really hard to talk about this particular aspect.
You know, there are things like the foreclosure crisis or the opiate addiction or the white pain in the presidential campaign that manifests as anger and xenophobia and all of that. But there's a way in which a lot of what happened to people of color, African Americans in particular, and tribal people in particular, is now afflicting white people as well. Like, these systems didn't stay closed. Mm-hmm. The structures didn't mm-hmm. stay closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think... I think where I see it is in fractured alliances. So I think part of the price of the ticket, for instance, is that these disaffected poor white people see themselves as white before they understand themselves as poor, right? So mm-hmm. there's a potentially very powerful alliance between poor whites and poor blacks in our country. Mm-hmm. And that alliance has been undermined by a history that encourages white people to think about themselves as primarily white, you know, to identify there first yeah. before identifying, you know, with their with other people who are working class, for instance. You also can see this in the women's movement, right? It's one of the major critiques of the women's movement is the way in which African-American women were excluded and the way in which the movement failed to embrace and build on the intelligence and concerns of African-American women. So, again, you have a really important liberation movement undermined by racial fracturing. And again, I think that that's a place where, you know, someone like me, a white woman, right? I've paid for, I guess, part of the price of the ticket for me is paid in the fact that I do not have an alliance with all other women across all racial groups, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. that would serve me well.
Yeah.
And that it would be, you know, intellectually that's more important to me than being identified as white, right? Or yeah. identifying with this racial group. Yeah. But the fracturing that we have, the social fracturing that we have, prevents alliances.
Mm-hmm. And prevents flourishing, right? Prevents life-giving for those fractures to soften and go fall away.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. ultimately, I think who it benefits is a very tiny, tiny little segment of the society. You know, those people who are, you know, who fall into every group of advantage, right? It's, yeah. You know, so white men who are upper class and have social access, when that's really just a tiny, tiny little percentage of, I guess mm-hmm. we're really, you know, this is another way of talking about the 1%, right? Mm-hmm. It's, but part of how we've empowered the 1% is by allowing other people to think that by virtue of their race, they might have access to the 1%.
Right.
That all they need to do is work hard enough and try hard enough and be good enough and that they might get to belong.
Or their children might get to belong at some
point. Or their children might, yeah. And I think that that's part of why where the anger that is driving Trump yeah. supporters is coming from is yeah. that's not a promise that has played out, right? It's yeah. it hasn't delivered.
I just want to make sure because we got going a little late. Want to make sure that the studio is Chris. Do you know? Okay, so I just think 15 or 20 more minutes. Okay, yeah, I want to come back to raising our children. And of course, that's you know, that's a primary place we can walk with this differently. You write very beautifully about, you've written in many ways about, you know, raising your son, the ordinary joys of life. You did mention a while ago how you wrote in that Times piece on White Debt about, I think this must be what you were talking about, what somebody took exception to, that when your son was four, he brought home a library book about the slaves who built the White House. I'm just going to read this. I didn't tell him that slaves once accounted for more wealth than all the industry in this country combined, or that slaves were, as Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, the down payment on this country's independence, or that freed slaves became, after the Civil War, this country's second mortgage. Nonetheless, my overview of slavery and Jim Crow left my son worried about what it meant to be white, what legacy he had inherited. "I don't want to be on this team," he said, with his head in his hands. "You might be stuck on this team," I told him, "but you don't have to play by its rules."
Yeah. And that, you know, that "you don't have to play by its rules" part is of course, easier said than done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that for me is an ongoing parenting challenge, but it's also a challenge for me as an adult living an adult life.
Yeah.
Is where and when do I refuse the rules, right? Where and when do I defy expectations that are written into the social code?
Yes.
For me it's tricky because because rules are so important, right, for both parenting and for education, right? So our children's lives are little nets of rules.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's actually a pretty complicated, nuanced conversation to talk about how do you discern whether a rule is unjust or not, and when do you choose to violate it. But for me, it's been really, really important to remain connected to and to continue to educate myself on a history of resistance, right? And particularly a history of white resistance. And there's in many different forms, right? And right now, recently, I've been studying very old resistant movements. I've been studying a group of people called the Blacks in England that were 17th century peasants who were resisting kind of privatization of land. And some of their resistance was humorous and playful, and some of it was dead serious. And they, for example, protested poaching laws in the forest, laws that favored the rich by killing deer in the forest. And the Blacks were met by legislation called the Black Act. And the Black Act made 50 different activities, including going in disguise. So the Blacks blacked their faces with soot, and that's why they were called the Blacks. And so blacking your face with soot was one of the 50 criminal offenses that could be punished by the death penalty under this legislation.
Yeah.
And, you know, touching that history is a reminder to me that there's a really long legacy of resistance here and of brutal repression of resistance, too. And I guess I'm not sure what more to say on that other than, for me, it's incredibly heartening to see that and to see that going back hundreds of years, people have been saying no to the structures around them that they find wrong and oppressive. It's also scary, and that people have been systematically oppressed for that and killed and hanged and imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't know where I'm going.
Well, yeah, and I also feel again, we live in this moment of, which is of, you know, of African American people being shot because they were stopped in their car, and also, but not just that, realizing that this has been going on, and somehow, because, you know, is it because people have cell phones and iPads with them. I mean, somehow we're seeing it and it's being captured, and you know, that fact that it's been happening and we didn't see it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is what is really the crime that we have all committed. But I also feel like the promise of this moment is our eyes being opened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you were talking a little while ago about the study about high schools and AP classes. So, I was thinking as you were talking about that, you know, my son went to a great big urban high school in St. Paul, and we liked that about it, that it was a big urban high school and it was diverse. But a new friend of mine who's African-American talked about taking his son to visit that school and being there at lunchtime. And being there at lunchtime and seeing this high school cafeteria where kids, you know, where kids, where you have all these high school kids being high school kids and they're laughing and they're talking and it was very mixed. And then the bell rings and the white kids head up the stairs to the AP and IB classes. And hardly any black kids. That's what everybody, you know, so you have this color, this stark segregation. And what feels so shameful to me is that I mean, my son has graduated now, and he had graduated by the point that I heard this story. And I knew that there was a segregation going on that I didn't understand and I didn't like, but I didn't. I was never there at lunchtime. I never saw that. And I, like, why? It is our job, right, as white parents, as much as it's the job of the parents of the kids of color, to not let this continue.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And that's, I've been very inspired by a number of things that I've read in a journal that's no longer being published called Race Traitor. And this was published by Noel Ignatieff, who I mentioned, the author of How the Irish Became White, and John Garvey published this journal for years. And one of the stories I read in there was about a group of parents who protested the selection processes in their school that produced a gifted program in a school that was majority black. The gifted program was majority white.
Yeah.
And so so white parents protested this, saying this can't possibly be the case, right? Not all the gifted children in this school can be white.
Yeah.
So there must be a problem with how we're deciding who gets into the gifted program. There must be something wrong here. And I do think that that's our job, right, as white parents, is to see that and know it can't be true. And then to try to, whatever that system is that's producing a gifted program that is entirely white at a school that's mostly black, to dismantle that system. Again, easier said than done. But I do think that there are, in these particular cases, there are things that can be done if people say we won't have this. I was also really inspired by a story that I heard on public radio here in Chicago a couple years ago about a group of students at a very wealthy public school in Lincoln Park. And these students were, many of them were white students who were protesting the fact that their school was going to get a major renovation that would cost a lot of money. And they were protesting on the grounds that they didn't think their school was the most in need of the public schools in the city. And they thought that it was unjust that that city funds would be going towards their school when there were schools that didn't have enough textbooks to go around. And I also found that story quite exciting and thought, okay, we're getting somewhere here.
Yeah. how, as you're out there talking about this, and as you've gotten a reaction to the black, to the white debt piece, is there a difference in how? Well, so I say one thing. I watched online. I watched kind of a book, of, or yeah, it was a book event you did. Maybe it was for Notes from No Man's Land, which also touched on a lot of these issues. Something that was interesting to me is that people were asking you questions about your reactions to things, almost as though it wasn't about them, right? Almost as though they weren't implicated, or I don't know. It was almost like they were disassociated from the. The fact of whiteness that you were talking about. But I'm curious about that. But also, I just wonder if there's a different reaction. Like, how do people of color respond? Do you hear from them, from non-white people about this thinking?
Yeah, I do. I do. And, you know, that's when I started writing about whiteness and writing about race. So quite a long time ago, that first book came out in 2009, but I'd been writing it for 7 years. I understood my intention as talking to white people about whiteness.
Yeah.
So it wasn't my expectation that that anyone else would necessarily find much of what I was saying particularly illuminating or interesting.
Yeah.
But I have gotten, I've gotten positive, supportive, and also challenging notes from people across the spectrum, from all different racial backgrounds. And I think... when people do, in writing, identify themselves to me, now I'm getting a tickle again, sorry.
It's okay.
I do hear from a lot of mixed-race people who I do think have a special, I guess a special place in a polarized conversation in a polarized society, right? Where especially people, there's mixed race people who can pass and who might in some circumstances be white and be understood as white and treated as white, and in other circumstances be seen as black and be treated as black. Mm-hmm. And I think that people who are in that position have some really interesting insights into this problem. But yeah, you know, I guess I'm not sure this is answering your question, but I guess one of the things that surprised me in terms of response to my own work was that for the most part, my writing about race did not seem to make a lot of people very upset. And that worried me a little bit, actually, to tell you the truth. You know, that some of my writing more recently has, in fact, made people upset. And just the other day, my husband sent me a picture of a poster he saw in our library here. Mm-hmm. I think it's a poster from the 60s. And the poster says, you're nobody till somebody hates you. And and I actually, you know, I think that's somewhat true, especially if you're a writer in this subject matter, you're probably not doing your job unless people are pissed off and angry.
But I mean, that's a diagnosis of a problem, isn't it? I mean, I wonder if you're just being kind of straight. You're saying, let's talk about whiteness. You're framing the question a little differently. Gosh, we've got to have a place for... speaking honestly, that it's not that controversial, even if it's not everybody's experience. And I don't know.
I have to say, you know, this is something, maybe this is also from my experience and position as a teacher. And maybe it has something to do with who I am also as a learner. But one of the things I've observed in education, and this is something I don't feel like it's talked about a lot in education, is that learning can be really, really upsetting, and it can set off a lot of negative emotions. Mm-hmm. It can set off anger. It can set off fear. It can set off hatred towards the person who's teaching you. I don't think that learning happening right always looks as
like
as
a pleasant epiphany
as we'd like to imagine it is. Yeah. And I know that's true of my own learning. Mm-hmm. I know that I've been in situations where I've been learning rapidly difficult lessons. I've been furious and mm-hmm. I've been reactive mm-hmm. and I've been frustrated, and I do sometimes see that with my own students too, who are, you know, for the most part, many of my students are extremely poised, well-behaved Midwestern or you know, middle American students who don't throw tantrums, I guess, is the way to say it. But still, I see every once in a while some anger, some frustration break out. And I do think that that it's fair to expect that in a conversation that's as difficult as this, there will be flashes of defensiveness, of anger, of bitterness, of ferocious resentment, and that I guess the space has to contain that. Mm.
There's something hopeful about taking in fury as a function of learning.
I actually, you know, maybe it's because I have a terrible temper myself, but I'm inclined to embrace fury not just in an academic setting, but in a conversation in general, in any essential conversation, I think probably has the potential to set off some anger. Mm.
Another aspect of this moment is that I hear language, and not just language, but intentions surfacing, you know, words mm-hmm. like, I wrote some of them down. Well, like, I mean, if, you know, people are talking about truth and reconciliation commissions mm-hmm. for race and, mm-hmm. What's the word that's escaping me that Bryan Stevenson uses, you know, I cannot think. Mercy, you know. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. using words like mercy in mm-hmm. conversations about public policy. You know, words like redemption, I feel, are coming in, and you have reflected on, and I feel like this is a new opening, you know, to say how do we live redemptively, reparatively, mm-hmm. rather than destructively. What does that look like? How does it start? You had this stunning sentence in your speaking about your book on immunity, which was, you know, tangentially about this subject. But, you know, we may find if we get into this that almost everything tangentially mm-hmm. touches on race, you know, where you mm-hmm. said, I understood that if I really believed in living reparatively, I was going to have to act out that belief through my son's body.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that wasn't for me an easy realization, mm-hmm. and I don't think it is for many people. It was actually, you know, in the moment, somewhat devastating for me to realize that that if I really believed what I thought I believed, it was acting on those beliefs was going to involve accepting some risk for my own child. Mm-hmm. And I did, you know, but it would be a lie to say it was easy. And, and I think, you know, part of the difficulty came from the fact that I was very awake to, the realities around, I guess the real risks of vaccination, right? So that's the other thing that kind of falls silent sometimes in our conversation around vaccination is that
and that was the topic of on immunity.
Yes, that was the topic of that book, and which, you know, I was actually surprised to find myself talking about race and privilege again in that book, and I should not have been, as you say, this is in everything. But when I initially entered that subject, I thought that that I would be in entirely new terrain, and that I was forging a project that would be making entirely new arguments. Instead, in many ways, I picked up a thread of thinking that I'd left off in Notes from No Man's Land about privilege, and thought through what, to my eye, was just a single specific example in the case of vaccination.
Whether
will
vaccine
you accept
shot, right.
some risk?
Right.
You know, will you accept some risk to protect another person?
Right.
That's kind of the question that vaccination raises for me. And sometimes that question gets a little bit distorted because sometimes we're expected, if you're pro-vaccination, you're expected to insist that vaccination does not involve risk, right?
Right.
But it does.
Right.
The risks are quite minimal, especially compared to lots of other things that we do, like driving in cars.
Right.
But it's still real, and I do think that to think about it well, we do have to acknowledge that the risk is real, but also acknowledge that the rewards are real and that the rewards are significant. And that, I guess, the work of being in a society, right, being a functional member of a society does not come without its risks, right? It's, we're not guaranteed a place in the society that is going to be safe for us in every way. And I think many people who are not white understand that, and quite a few people who are white believe that they're entitled to safety in every realm of their lives.
It's like a birthright.
In no matter the cost to other people, too.
Right.
And so in this way, I found I was somewhat caught off guard by how much the debate around vaccination mirrored some of the conversations that I'd been part of around race and racial privilege.
You've also been reflecting on the notion of apology. Just as we finish here, is that one step in living reparatively, especially for those of us who are white?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. This is something I wrote an essay called All Apologies, where I tried to think through this question of are there crimes that were too significant to be apologized for, right? And and does something like slavery fall into that category? Something that a wrong for which there is no apology. And I wrestled with that in that essay. And I think in the end, where I've come out as a thinker is with the belief that apologies are not insignificant. And even when they're symbolic, that you can make symbolic gestures that can be restorative. But that an apology alone is not going to right a wrong. So, as you say, it could be an important part of a process. And just the other night, I was at a forum here at Northwestern where three researchers were talking about Native American history and in the context of thinking about how do we right the wrongs that were done, and is anything going to right this wrong? And one of the women who was speaking was talking about actually a truth and reconciliation movement in Canada to address the ways in which First Nation people had been wronged in Canada, And specifically, there was an effort there to compensate people who, native peoples who had been sent to re-education schools. So children who had been institutionalized, taken away from their families, and sent to schools that were meant to assimilate them into the non-native society. And that the government is now compensating people who were put through this traumatic experience. And to her, to the speaker, that was meaningful. That was a gesture that it's not going to undo the wrong and it's not going to right the wrong, but having the government of a country acknowledge the wrong and call it a wrong and then make some you know, largely symbolic but still material gesture to address that wrong is that was feeling significant to this particular speaker. And I don't want to assume it would feel significant to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think that sort of gesture is a start. I think it's a starting point. And that we probably aren't going to get anywhere from denying that a wrong has been done.
Mm-hmm. But I think also what you're saying is that if apologies or that kind of gesture are offered, that they need to be understood in the moment they're being offered as a first step rather than a conclusion.
Right. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I think many people would say, I certainly feel this way, that there is no financial reparation that would compensate the loss of native lands and native culture, right? We can't make a payment that will right that wrong, balance that debt. And the same is true for slavery, right? There is no reparation that will repay that debt. But that doesn't mean we can't acknowledge it. Acknowledge that the debt is there, that it was a wrong, and that the wrongdoing didn't end with slavery.
Yeah.
And I think signal that we as a society are committed to I'm not sure, I guess to another way of living, right? That isn't parasitic on the people around us.
Mm-hmm. That we have to. That, and again, you and I are speaking as two white people. That mm-hmm. we have to craft and kind of discover that new way of living, kind of one life and one action at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find this super embarrassing to talk out loud about, really.
Yeah.
Like
no, it feels really scary, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I'm like already pre-mortified about any of this being on the air on the radio. As much as like I think I'm allowing this embarrassment to just wash over me because I still like really deeply fundamentally believe in bumbling your way through a conversation about this subject because I think it is so important. We just cannot be silent
right, because
on
it's
subject.
So inadequate. Is what you're saying.
It's very inadequate. Yeah. I feel like, and I also, you know, as we talk, I just feel super aware of my own. Like partial understanding, you know, and mm-hmm. and I feel like I'm constantly touching the edges of my own
right.
comprehension, and I'm aware that I'm really not getting it all, and so it feels just very uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
And intensely mortifying.
But do you think it's, I mean, yeah, I know, I'm with you. It also feels like we have to start somewhere, that it's necessary.
I think so. Yeah, I really do. And I guess, you know, as both a teacher and just a person who lives a life and a parent, I just am a huge believer in hard conversations.
But I think to your point also, we need to also allow ourselves to have inadequate conversations.
Yeah.
And not think that we have to begin by getting it right or perfect or complete.
Right.
Because
right.
It's not possible. As you said, we're talking about generation upon generation. And
yeah.
Things that have been conscious and unconscious, and we don't even ourselves comprehend. You and I, even though we've done a lot mm-hmm. of reflecting on this, don't know how much we carry around unconsciously. Like that's something we're learning about ourselves.
Yeah. You know, the very first question my son ever asked me about race, it wasn't that long after he started talking. So he was somewhere between 2 and 3. And he asked me, I was anticipating a question like this, but I did not anticipate the form it took. He asked me why a friend of his had brown skin. And I was expecting a question like that. But what was surprising was that the friend he asked about was someone who would be considered white.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her background is Romanian,
mm-hmm.
but her features are European, and she moves through the world as a white person, and so does her mother. And but her skin is in fact darker than the skin of a number of other people we knew who would be classified as black.
Yeah.
So the very first question my son asked me about race was much more complicated than the question I'd been anticipating. What he was asking me is, why is this person with dark skin called white when there's people with lighter skin who we call black? And that wasn't a question I was prepared to answer. I was ready for the, why do we call this friend who's categorized as black, why does he have brown skin? I was ready for that one.
Yeah.
But I wasn't ready for, why do white people have brown skin? What he was really getting at is a question that went straight to the inconsistencies in how we define race in this country,
yeah.
right? And
some of the absurdity of it.
Mm-hmm. it. And what I realized from that question, he was very, very young. I also realized how much he already understood. And I was quite taken aback by that. He already understood that this girl's category was white. He knew that. What he was confused about was why her skin didn't seem to match her category.
Somewhere you pose these two questions together, or these two ideas, the things we do to each other out of fear, the things mm-hmm. we owe each other.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how that idea, that question, flows into your sense of what it means to be human. Like, mm-hmm. what do you take from all of this reflecting and writing that you've done? How mm-hmm. does it expand and give contour to that question? Where you start to think about that. What does it mean to be human?
Yeah. I can't even begin to answer that. But I guess I could poke at it a little bit.
Yeah.
And say that I think that what makes us human is in what we share, and I do think that we're to the degree that we're successful in sharing both a society and a culture and resources and a community, we're more fully human, and that we degrade our own humanity when we fail in that project of sharing both the things we've already built together and the things that are available to us. I don't know. Is that too wide an answer?
No, well, they'll just no. It's a ridiculous question. But so how would you if this were a list? You know, the things we this phrase I really like this the things we owe each other. You know,
yeah.
What are those things? What are just some of those things that we owe each other? As you've come to think about this.
Yeah, I think about this all the time. That particular question: what do we owe to other people? What do we owe to the people we love? What do we owe to the people who we don't know, who are strangers? And I have an ever shifting thought landscape around that. But I do think, and this comes back to fear, I have come to believe that we owe it to other people not to be afraid of them. Mm. And I've come to feel very strongly about that. I think fear is a deceptively destructive emotion. And it's not just disabling in terms of the person who is fearful. It can be you can be undone by your own fear. But the thing that I think goes under-recognized is that fear is very violent, and that quite a bit of damage is done to people who are feared by the fearful.
But again, you could hear somebody. I can just hear the person of color. You know, that mother who sends her child out reasonably every morning in fear. Saying that that is a position of privilege. And I know what you're talking about because fear
Absolutely.
Is one of the most violent, destructive forces in our life together right now. But this gets us right back to the question of the inequality of our privilege.
Exactly. Yes. And I think that it's a really important point that you just made. And I'm not really sure how to meet that other than saying that I think that that's fear that's happening in a different social context, right? Mm-hmm. And it's I hate to like divide fear into rational and irrational. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. those terms are really inadequate, but maybe earned and unearned, you know. Mm-hmm. It's that fear that Kenyan mother in my son's school feels about sending her kids out into the world every day, that's earned.
Yep.
And I think that there are other sorts of fear, particularly many of the fears that white people nurture that are unearned fears.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this book called The Culture of Fear, where I can't actually remember the author's name, but he does a great job of pointing out, you know, one of the things he says is that there are just more dangers out there than we can reasonably have fear for. So every culture, every society decides what it's going to be afraid of. So all of us are making decisions all the time about fear, choosing what we're going to be afraid of, what we're not going to be afraid of. And we're just not going to ever cover every danger. It wouldn't be possible, and it also wouldn't be psychologically healthy.
Yeah.
But what he does point out is he does a great job of pointing out a particular kind of, contradiction in American society, where as a society we tend to nurture fears of the very kinds of people that are most vulnerable in the society.
Yeah.
So one of his examples is black men. And he says, you know, black men are an object of fear in this society. And it's hard to find another group of people who are more politically, socially, and culturally vulnerable than black men.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I guess one way I make a distinction is we can't ask people to put themselves in the way of danger, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have a tendency, and I guess our brains work this way, to see, you know, the dangerous leader or a dangerous, you know, event or exemplar, and then associate an entire group of people as dangerous. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's, you're saying that's a fear that's chosen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who is it? The philosopher Zizek, right, who talks about this as lying in the guise of truth. So, so where something may happen that is a true event. And I think he was talking about Katrina when he used this term, lying in the guise of truth. So say a store gets looted in the wake of Katrina. This one instance is then used to animate racist fantasies.
Right.
You know, so a store is looted, therefore all black people are thieves.
Yeah.
You know, a person is shot, therefore all black people are violent and potentially murderous. That term, lying in the guise of truth, was really helpful to me in the way it illuminated the lies that we manufacture out of actual events.
Mm-hmm.
So something can actually happen, but it doesn't mean what we think it means.
You know, what's interesting about the path we just took is, you said something that I believe is true, that fear is dangerous and disabling, mm-hmm. and it has a violent force in our life together.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, even as we start to interrogate that, you know, there's white fear and black fear, and mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. it has, you know, we still have to, I don't know, we have to, it's complicated, it's complex. Say a little bit more about what would be on your list of the things we owe each other.
Well, again, I think this is in some ways very, you know, very personal for me, you know, because I do ask this question of myself, for myself, all the time.
Mm.
But one of my kind of private conclusions for my own self, and this has to do with fear, but it's slightly different, is that I do feel that we owe each other trust until that trust is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be, in practice, incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I was thinking through in On Immunity, in this book about vaccination. I was thinking through why is it so hard for us as mothers to trust all these doctors and scientists, many of them mothers themselves, who are marshaling all this evidence that vaccination is safe and a risk worth taking for us and our children. And I do think that we live in a political climate, in a political atmosphere that makes trust extremely difficult, and it can even seem quite foolish,
actually, to
trust in this particular climate. And I think there's people who would disagree with me on this, and probably rightly. So I guess that's just my way of saying that I'm not entirely sure that what I'm saying is right. I'm maybe even partly convinced I'm wrong on this, but it's still something that I've come to that is important to me, is that I, in my everyday interactions with other people, I feel that trust is something of a radical act. Mm-hmm. And I go to great efforts to trust the people around me.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for me to observe how difficult that is in various situations. And there's situations where it isn't difficult, right? But observing the differences, it has been really instructive to me.
And do you find that is a risk that has rewards? Is to talk about the paradigm before. I mean, do you find that many people in situations rise to that occasion? That it's worth it for you to go through the erring on the side of trust?
For me, it has been. It's a rewarding way to live, and I do think that doesn't mean that people haven't disappointed me and broken my trust. But it tends when that happens to me, it tends to be in situations where I never would have anticipated it, you know? And I feel like this does come back to the question of fear. I think there's some people who feel that nurturing their own fear will be a balm against danger. If you just feel fearful enough and often enough, you'll save yourself from the dangers of the world. And I do think that there's also this sense, if you're not trusting, if you're just suspicious enough and wary enough, that you won't be hurt. And I don't think that's true. I think you get hurt either way. So you get to live as a suspicious, wary person, paranoid, who gets hurt, or you get to live as someone who trusts other people and gets hurt. Mm. I'm not sure if that's it.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful and
uplifting conclusion.
Yeah. And no, and in this term, in this context of whiteness, you know, what do we owe as white people? I mean, is guilt? This is almost like opening up the entire discussion again. But what would kind of be the first thing that came to you with that question?
You know, this is a question that I do, again, I'm asking myself all the time and trying to answer in actually very concrete ways. Mm-hmm. And my answer is, again, constantly evolving and constantly shifting.
Yeah.
But I do feel that I owe action to the communities that I'm a part of. And those communities are various and overlapping. But for instance, the whole reason I was in a meeting at my son's school to talk about an event we were going to have around talking about race is I feel that I owe it to that community to be involved in making race something that we're talking about in the schools and with children and with teachers. And I guess I feel that also in my community. So as a teacher, as an educator, I feel that it's something that I feel I owe it to that community to bring up the question of race when we're doing hiring and when we're inviting guests to speak.
Right,
and
right.
You know, and that's something I fail on too. And I feel that I also owe it to my neighbors not to reduce them to symbols, right? Mm. That's the other thing that feels very of real potential danger to me is that that every individual in a racial group can be reduced to a...
right.
You know, a symbol of that group as a whole. And so I feel that I owe it to the people around me, to my next door neighbors, to the people that I'm close with, to my friends, to fellow writers, to see them as people and not as symbols of or ideas or shorthand for an experience that we assume is shared and may not be shared.
Okay, I think I've worked too hard enough.
I hope I've given you enough to work with. I know I've kind of I've gone off track a little
no,
bit.
No, it's okay. I think that, as you said earlier, this is so complicated that it's hard to talk about, and it's also frightening to talk about because it's charged, and also because we care about getting it right, and also we actually know because we have a sense of the complexity that we're not going to.
Yeah.
So I think that is partly what you're contributing, kind of sticking your neck out there.
Well, and you're asking all these great questions, like really terrific questions that are, I think a lot of them just feel to me unanswerable.
Yeah.
You know, which I think that's the work of an essayist, right? To stab at unanswerable questions. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. like that's what I do. So I feel like I have to be game for unanswerable questions.
Yeah.
But it's still, I feel like that's, you know, that's it. At the end of the conversation, we still, there's no great moment of, you know, conclusion, because we've just wallowed around in some unanswerable
for a while. Yeah, but I don't think we would have been true to the conversation, to the subject, mm-hmm. if we had pretended like there could be a conclusion.
Yes, and now we've figured it out all out, and it'll be okay.
It's been great. I'm really grateful for what you're doing and for the conversation. So thank you so much, and thanks for giving me all this time.
Of course, it was a real pleasure to talk with you.